From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, a wartime view of Mother's Day, what it's like to be a mom deployed in Iraq. Also, a move to limit military recruiters in California high schools, and how a writing workshop helps cancer survivors cope.
It really helps a lot because the fact that you laugh, you cry, you just get it out of your system, you feel good about it. And when you feel good about it, you feel good about life.
Those stories plus home designer Cliff May, how his modern ranch homes defined California living.
What's interesting about Cliff is that he was an inventor. He's part of that classic American strain of self-invented people.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Good to have you with us. It's the California Report. This Mother's Day weekend, millions of moms will be getting breakfast in bed, bouquets of flowers, handmade cards from their kids, and there's got to be some chocolate in there somewhere. Even moms deployed in Iraq will be treated special. They're getting a spa day. Mothers from the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps will give each other facials, manicures, and pedicures in the Green Zone Sunday. Today, there are some 12,000 women deployed in Iraq. Former Air Force Captain Patricia Matthews of Santa Clara remembers how hard it was being apart from her four-year-old daughter, Madison, when she was in Iraq in 2003 and 2004.
I talked with her, and I explained to her we got a calendar, and I showed her how many months I thought I would be gone, and I had prepared videotapes and audio tapes of reading books, and one of the final big conversations that we had, I started getting a bit emotional, and she said, Mommy, remember you told me to save my tears for important things? And she said, you'll be back quick as a flash. She said that I shouldn't worry, that everything was going to be okay. So she was actually the one that put me at ease, and everything seemed to come together at that point prior to leaving.
And so once you got over there and the reality of being away from your family and Madison, your four-year-old, soon-to-be five-year-old, I guess, daughter, what went through your mind? What in your quieter moments when you had a chance to think about her, what did you think about?
I thought about the fact that at any moment I could cease to exist on this earth, and there was not much that I could do about that. And I thought about the fact that she was so young, and I wasn't sure that she had enough memories about me to be able to hold on to in the event that something, God forbid, happened. I just wanted her to know that she was loved and was the most wonderful gift.
Well, I know that this weekend in Iraq, they're having a spa day for moms who are over there. What do you imagine it's like for them now, given where the war is? It's a very different place and a different war than it was when you were there in 2003 and 2004. What do you imagine this weekend is like for those moms and for their kids back here?
Oh, I think the kids now are much more aware of what's going on. You're just inundated with information and the news and the media, the papers, the radio, and you can't really escape it. Back then, it wasn't as much. And I think now there's a lot more communication avenues for them. That definitely has improved significantly. And if you can at least hear someone's voice, let them know, versus waiting, you know, 3 or 4 weeks for a letter, receiving an email, a text message, something, I think it helps out a lot because you remain more connected to your children, to your family.
How hard is it to come back to the country after being over there? What's the readjustment like?
Back then, readjusting was very difficult. I think I personally wasn't prepared for emotionally, I think, what I was going to see, what I was going to be exposed to. And you change as a person. There really wasn't anything at that time that provided me some information or guidance or perspective on how my relationship with my family, with my daughter, with my husband would change because of my experience there. And it took a while. It took actually a few months, and I was only there for a short time compared to what the majority of deployments are now. And even that what seems like a glimpse of time now. It seemed like an eternity, but that significantly changed my life, and I think forever that will have changed my life. And I tried to do the best I could in readjusting and getting back into my role as mom and wife. And meanwhile, I had a lot of things on my mind that were left from back there, where I felt like a completely different person. I never, despite being in the military, never fathomed that I'd be in a war zone. So I just had to take it step by step, and, you know, lessons learned. And I'm anything that I can do to help families or military members, their children, to readjust or let them know that there are a lot of programs out there now that help people realize that what they're feeling, they're not the only ones. You're not alone.
Well, other than your welcome home event this weekend, how will you be spending Mother's Day on Sunday?
Mother's Day will hopefully be spent with my mom, who lives in Southern California, and my husband and our daughter. So we have a few surprises planned there. And for Mother's Day, I mostly think of, I'm very appreciative if my family thinks of me. But now that we're here in California, back on the mainland and no more deployments, I take every opportunity on Mother's Day to be able to see my mom. And she has just been so wonderful. When our daughter was born, she traveled to Italy where she was born and stayed with us there. Everywhere we've been stationed, with the exception of the deployment sites, she's come to visit and be there. And I'm just still tying up the loose ends of the surprises for my mom.
Well, great. Well, Patricia Matthews, thanks for your service to the country and happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's former Air Force Captain Patricia Matthews. She's helping to organize a welcome home event in the San Francisco Bay Area this weekend for service members and vets of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Military recruiters have their work cut out for them these days. The Army has lowered standards and increased signing bonuses to meet its recruitment goals. In California, the military has to contend with a strong anti-recruitment movement. And a new bill by a state assemblywoman would make recruiters' jobs even harder. Her proposal would limit access to high school students' contact information. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman-Lopez has more.
It's the end of a school day at Roosevelt High School. Thousands of students are streaming out of the East Los Angeles campus. Three of them are leaving with Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Nicolas Perez.
We're going to go to Foster's Freeze.
And what are you going to do?
Eat some stuff. Probably ice cream. You want ice cream?
Yes, sir.
You want an ice cream? We're going to go have ice creams. It's a hot day.
And you're going to talk about the Marine Corps, right?
No. Actually, we're not. We're going to eat ice cream. Ready?
Roosevelt High teacher Arlene Inouye approaches the recruiter and asks if he's the one who leafleted teachers requesting time for classroom talks.
Have you scheduled any?
Have I scheduled any? No, nobody's called me yet.
Inouye began working as a speech therapist at the school about a decade ago.
Oh, in 1997-98, when I first started at the school, I was stunned because there were military recruiters talking to students inside the school at lunch, at recess, during nutrition, after school. They were walking around.
Public schools can't prohibit contact between recruiters and students. State and federal laws allow recruiters to obtain students' telephone numbers and addresses. Almost 4 years ago, Inouye started a counter-recruitment group on campus. She and other teachers and students widely distribute forms that allow parents to keep their kids' information private. A new bill proposed by State Assemblywoman Sally Lieber would compel schools to send these forms home with every student's emergency contact paperwork. Roosevelt High teacher Carlos Castillo joined the group. He counters the recruiter's pitch by telling students to go to college. Castillo grew up in East L.A. When he was in the eighth grade, he thought about enlisting.
I can't remember a teacher ever telling me that was the greatest idea. I think that I remember teachers kind of, when I would say, you know, I want to join the military, that most of the teachers said, that's good, that's a really good opportunity for you.
He says some teachers still assume that condescending tone toward the mostly working class Latino students on campus. Teachers and students at dozens of other Southern California campuses have started their own counter-recruitment groups.
Thank you for coming to our workshop. My name is Marwin Young, and I'm one of the coordinators for Equality for All. And today our workshop is going to be on countering military recruitment.
At nearby Franklin High School, almost two dozen students and several teachers listened to senior Marwin Young's lunch hour critique of military recruiters.
For them to come to our schools to recruit students, where this is supposed to be an educational facility, I believe it's wrong. And one thing to think about is, what schools are they targeting? The schools that they usually target are communities of color. And for example, you have recruitment at Franklin, Lincoln, Roosevelt, Garfield, Wilson.
Those recruiters often use the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps programs to talk to students. During Marwin Young's workshop, U.S. Army Sergeant Major Don Thomas, the school's junior ROTC instructor, defended the program at Franklin High.
We're basically a physical education program, and what we do is be very serious about physical education.
Franklin High's junior ROTC is about 150 students strong, Thomas said. He added that recruiters visit the campus to talk about the military, but there's no push to join. Supervisors at the nearby recruiting station did not respond to repeated interview requests for this story. Walking home from school, Roosevelt High senior Jose Alberto Garcia said military recruiters came to campus to encourage him to enlist, but he has other plans.
I want to become a Chicano Studies teacher. Try to educate students about their culture.
He didn't reach his decision lightly. His 23-year-old brother is an Army sergeant stationed in Iraq. Garcia says that even though he opposes the war, he's proud of what his brother's accomplished, and he's looking forward to his next visit in December. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
Cliff May is hardly a household name, but the homes he designed went a long way toward defining California living in the mid-20th century. Walls of glass, easy access to the outside, carports, and skylights. May's suburban ranch homes were inspired by his Spanish heritage and his childhood home in San Diego. Now, 100 years after his birth, a new book profiles May's distinctive style in a career that spanned seven decades. Cliff May and the Modern Ranch House is written by former Sunset Magazine editor Dan Gregory.
What's interesting about Cliff is that he was an inventor. He's part of that classic American strain of self-invented people. He was very talented. He was not trained as an architect. However, he started as a furniture builder, and he could build from what he saw. He was extremely good at solving problems. He could, and that's what led in. He's almost an engineer in that sense.
Define the characteristics of these ranch homes. Describe them for us, for someone who's never been in one.
Sure. Well, a ranch house has a pretty broad definition, but basically it's a one-story house that tends to ramble. The house is no more than one room wide, so each room connects to the outdoors in some way. Now, a really well-designed ranch house celebrates its site and celebrates that connection to the outdoors and outdoor living. The more contemporary ranch houses have other innovations that someone like Cliff May really helped invent and promote, and those would be the skylights that open up over the ridge beam, the use of plate glass in extensive areas, and a lot of electronic intercoms and things like that also.
There's a quote in the book from Cliff May, and I'll just read it quickly. He says, if you can't walk out of the living room or bedroom or kitchen onto the ground, if you have to go down steps, why, you're not living like a real Californian lives from the house to the patio. So these ranch homes were more than just style. They were about kind of a lifestyle.
Exactly, and that really was Cliff's point, that they're beyond style. They're really about the function. And in fact, in the book, I point out, in the 50s, there's the beginnings of a big debate in house design between, say, the modernist architect who's interested in form following function and the Cliff May ranch house designer who is also designing for function but is less interested in the actual form. It's more about how the plan functions and how you connect to your lifestyle.
You describe his designs as functionally modern, even futuristic, and warmly romantic. That strikes me as kind of a hard thing to blend, two things. How did he do that?
That's what makes Cliff May so interesting to my mind, because he was interested in history. In fact, the romance of early California, in his eyes, was a legitimate ingredient or element to incorporate in a new and modern home. He grew up in San Diego, working summers on his aunt's lima bean farm, which was part of an early California hacienda. And This is where he got his interest in the ranch house iconic sort of form. The evolution of his designs, they go from kind of a recreation of that hacienda to a much more modern, simplified approach, which is more abstract. He felt that there is no need to deny the sense of a history, even as you are building very modern forms that are all about the open plan.
So Cliff May designed about 1,000 of these homes, and then another 18,000 were built based on those designs. Where are they clustered in California, or are they all spread out?
Well, there is a subdivision in Cupertino. There are other individual houses all around Northern California. There's a major subdivision in Long Beach called the Long Beach Ranchos, which is being resuscitated. Many of these houses have been bought and are being restored by very eager and happy homeowners. His custom designs are all over the world.
And, of course, he designed Robert Mondavi's home in Napa.
That's correct.
That was one of the last homes he designed.
It's one of the last homes. It's done in the early 80s. And that house, I think, is wonderful because one of the points of the book is not just that Cliff May is all about indoor-outdoor living, but that these houses are really palindromes. They're sort of architectural palindromes. You know, a palindrome is a phrase you can say frontwards and backwards, like Wairika Bakery, for example. Well, I think these are architectural versions. And this house, the Mondavi House, does that perfectly because the pool is inside under a huge skylight. And Mrs. Mondavi told me, well, yes, so we swim inside, but then if the weather's nice, we roll the bed outside. So they sleep outside but swim inside. So that's a perfect reversal of the usual way of living.
Could he have been prolific as a designer, do you think, just as easily in Illinois? Or was there something unique about his being here that really is reflected?
Right. It's important, I think, that he started in California because California already had a mystique to it. But by the late 30s, early 40s, when Cliff May No. 3, the house he designed and built for his own family in Brentwood, was completed, the magazines like Sunset and House Beautiful had discovered Cliff as a sort of an exemplar of California living. And they saw California already as a place of innovation. And they were looking for someone who could be both modern and also have a connection to a past, to a sense of history. Cliff May was, they really hit pay dirt with Cliff May, both magazines. In fact, there's a mention in the book of Elizabeth Gordon, who was the editor of House Beautiful, who said that when she met him and saw his work, she had no idea what California living was. And he really explained and showed that to her. And it was a revelation to her, you know, House Beautiful being edited from New York City and the sense that there was a new world in the West.
Dan Gregory, he's the editor of houseplans.com, also was a senior home editor at Sunset Magazine for 27 years. And his new book is called Cliff May and the Modern Ranch House. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can take a virtual road trip to the Cliff May houses around California. Go to our website, californiareport.org, for an interactive map and a photo slideshow. Cancer is a word no one wants to hear from their doctor. Getting through chemotherapy and radiation is tough enough physically. There are also plenty of emotional challenges in dealing with a life-threatening disease. Some cancer survivors in California say they get a lot of help from writing workshops. KPBS reporter Kenny Goldberg has the story of one program in San Diego.
At Scripps Green Hospital in La Jolla, Sharon Bray faces a room full of cancer survivors. She asks them a series of point-blank questions.
Why do you need to survive? What keeps you going? What helps you survive?
Bray's questions are not rhetorical. All of these people have faced staggering challenges, a diagnosis of cancer, chemotherapy and radiation, and all of the side effects that go along with them. These folks are here to write about their feelings, their experiences, and share them with their fellow cancer survivors. Bray prompts them again.
Why do I need to survive? What pulls me forward and keeps me living? Okay, 10 minutes.
The survivors grab their pens and have at it. Sharon Bray is a cancer survivor herself. She discovered the healing power of writing when she was recovering from her treatments. Bray says cancer patients carry a lot of emotions around with them. Anger, sorrow, loss, depression.
When you give voice to those emotions. You're releasing them. You're getting them outside of yourself so that you can start to examine them and establish a different perspective.
Bray says research shows writing is therapeutic when you take your feelings and thoughts and convert them into a coherent narrative. And she says the most healing writing of all is done in the presence of others, where people share their stories. Karen Arose was diagnosed with breast cancer in late October and had a mastectomy just after Thanksgiving.
When I'm writing, I'm not really certain of what I'm writing. I'm just doing a stream of thought. But when I read it, I realize there is a pain I have and that I've been untouched. And so it gives a voice to feelings that I can't articulate to others or myself.
Arose says in the outside world, she tries to minimize her disease and what she's going through.
You don't want people to begin looking at you as someone different, as someone actually ill, and treat you differently. And so I put on a facade, and that facade becomes reality for me. And in this place, there's no room for a facade. There's no time for it. The writing's brief, it's prompted, and there's no time to edit yourself. It comes from the heart.
Sharon Bray calls the group back to order. They take turns sharing what they've written.
I'm not sure why I need to keep on living, but I do. Why? I like to cuddle, etc., with my sexy husband. I like to hear the song in my daughter's voice when she tells me some funny story.
As I was going through my chemo treatments, the question came to me, is it really worth going through this? There's no quality of life at all. Nothing tastes good, nothing feels right.
I will survive so I can create a suitcase of memories for my daughter. I want those ordinary days of walking to school, of wiping noses, of changing diapers, of lying on the grass looking up at the sky.
Survivor Mario Duran says he always walks out of the writing sessions feeling better.
It really helps a lot because the fact that you laugh, you cry, you just get it out of your system, you feel good about it. And when you feel good about it, you feel good about life.
Sharon Bray also leads a writing workshop at the Stanford Cancer Center in Palo Alto. Similar programs for cancer survivors are offered at the Wellness Community in Los Angeles and Sutter Health in Sacramento. For the California Report, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
This week we continue our California Songs series with Matthew Pryor. He's the singer and songwriter of the New Amsterdams. Pryor lives in Lawrence, Kansas, but he spent much of his adult life on the road. Before forming the New Amsterdams, he toured North America, Europe, and Japan with the popular indie rock band The Get Up Kids. We spoke to Pryor about his song From California and the challenges of balancing a young family with a musician's life on the road.
My name is Matt Pryor, and I'm the singer and songwriter for the New Amsterdams. The song is really not so much about California as much as it's about being gone and being away a lot. I wrote it after my daughter was born.
Coming a mile of the time at home, hardly a word on the telephone. Finally find the time to get to know ya. Mapping it out like a master plan, something to do with my idle hands. Write you a letter address from California.
And it has a lot to do with just my internal struggle with being a touring musician and being a good parent at the same time, and then also not wanting to be like my parents necessarily. So California has always been a pretty big part of my touring life, so that seemed like an obvious sort of choice for it.
Nothing if I don't know your mistakes. A pill is as bitter as I can take. Twist like a blade when I leave for California. La da, la da, da da, da da.
Trying to figure out what I do for a living and what I want to be as a parent, how they can kind of coexist together. And so part of it is that I do have to leave from time to time.
Hope that you know this is killing me. It's all in the name of the family. Only can play the cards the dealer dealt us. The end of the cycle is closing in. With you I see new hope begin again. It suddenly seems to be promising California.
I guess it was written to my daughter, but it was also sort of written to myself. It's sort of a, I'm just kind of talking to myself in it, but I guess it's written about her, but it's written to me. I'm reassuring myself that it's an okay decision to make, I guess, even though I sometimes don't totally believe it.
That's Matthew Pryor of the New Amsterdams talking about his song From California. You can find it on their album, Worse for the Wear. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical director. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Tom Krimkowski. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, Leanne Lucetta, and June Stinson. Reed Pilafont helped produce our California song. Joey Peters and Willie Aaron composed our theme music. The producers are Victoria Mullion and Erica Kelly. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Bruce Kuhn is the news director. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.